Four, please. Now, Riley.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Four Please, Now Driving, the official Masters podcast. I'm your host, Marty Smith. We'll be recording all week long here on property at Augusta National Golf Club, discussing the Masters tournament with some of your favorite celebrities, athletes, and entertainers. This is Friday, April 12th. On today's episode, we'll chat with ESPN's Mike Greenberg during this, his first trip to the Masters, about his love for the game of golf, and what Masters moment he thinks about first when asked about this historic tournament. We'll also have a conversation with NASCAR star Kyle Larson about going to the Masters for the first time and the golf league in which he and several of his competitors engage weekly. So without delay, let's turn off of Washington Road, proceed down the famed Magnolia Lane, and get to it. What a tremendous day of golf here on Friday at Augusta National. We have five players tied for the lead at 7 under par. Four more, including Tiger Woods, just one stroke off the lead. Pleased to welcome back Jimmy Roberts, voice of Masters Digital and NBC broadcaster. Jimmy, we'll get to the leaders in just a moment. But once again, the story, Tiger Woods. There are so many aspects to his performance Friday to discuss, but let's just discuss the overall performance first. 4 under 68, moves within one stroke of the lead. As we said, he entered the day Friday 2 under par, shoots 1 under on the front nine, and then produces a masterful second nine. What did you see from Tiger on Friday, Jimmy?
He was Houdini again. I mean, the guy makes it impossible to look away from. I mean, just everything about him seems to be just suffused in drama. Take what he does. The only person to birdie the 11th hole, the hole's impossible. He hits it left of the hole. Nobody hits it left of the hole. That's where you have to hit it. If you want an uphill putt, it's exactly what he did. He birdies the 11th hole. Then he moves to 12, hits a great tee shot. And so what happens? Of course, the horn goes off. And you just knew that was what was going to happen to him. Everything seemed to turn after the rain delay. It was only 30 minutes. He misses the 5-foot birdie putt on 12, misses a makeable birdie putt on 13, hits a bad drive on 14, and you think, this could definitely go in the wrong direction. It already looked like it was heading there. And then, to make matters worse, after he hits his second shot on 14, he ends up getting tangled up his feet with a security guard, and you're just thinking, this is just impossible. But what happens? He hits a magnificent shot. He makes the putt, hits a bad drive on 15, birdies the hole anyway, and Tiger Woods once again makes it impossible to look away from. And he's the only, by the way, he made 5 putts over 20 feet. The next best in that category was somebody with 3. So, I mean, again, he just a flair for the dramatic, and he is where he is.
We discussed this yesterday because it's so remarkable to witness in person. But to watch him leave the 18th and walk off the 18th to that raucous celebration and that raucous adoration from all of those patrons is a sight to behold like we rarely see. For someone who's not here and they're seeing it on television, what is it like to see in person?
People are fascinated by the guy, and I think today is a perfect example of why. He, over the years, I think, has this quality where he's one of the toughest battlers that I've ever seen. I think Tiger Woods, I've often said that I think Tiger Woods is who he is, not because he shot 63 more than anybody else, but because he's failed to shoot 76 more than anybody else. I've seen that guy turn 76 into 72 more times than you could possibly imagine. He had no business doing what he did on 14 and 15, but somehow he figures out a way. Now, a lot of it has to do with the extraordinary skill that allows him to hit the shot that he hit on 14. That second shot, was just crazy. But he's an extraordinarily talented person with an iron will, and he just, he never, ever mails it in.
His impact on the game is just unbelievable. There's a lot of golf to play.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the impact on the Masters for him to be in this position right now as we head towards moving day?
Well, I think you'll find that out when you see the ratings next week, but I think it's kind of obvious. It's going to bring an awful lot more people to the table who might not necessarily have been interested without his presence. I will say this, the Masters in and of itself attracts an extraordinary amount of attention among people who wouldn't otherwise be interested in golf. I saw an interesting stat this week where it was from the CEO of TaylorMade, where he said his company receives 50% more phone calls the Monday after the Masters than it gets on a normal day. So, I mean, I think that with or without Tiger, this is, we were talking about it yesterday. This is the show. With Tiger, it's the hyper show.
Let's discuss the leaders now. The names are Francesco Molinari, Jason Day, Brooks Koepka, Adam Scott, and Louis Oosthuizen, all tied at 7-under atop the leaderboard. Each took very different roads to the lead. Which stood out the most to you?
Well, I'll tell you what stands out the most to me. All of those names that you just mentioned, the first page of the leaderboard, they're all major champions. Mm-hmm. And, when you get down to a situation where the air is going to get a little bit more thin, the experience of having been in that cauldron and previously figured out how to breathe properly, and I don't mean literally breathe properly, I'm talking about how to get it done when something this big is at stake. I think there's really something to be said for that. And interestingly enough, the only one among that group who's won a Masters is Adam Scott. And as a matter of fact, the top 10 players in the world, none of them have won a Masters. It's a crowded leaderboard. I mean, there are a million stories. I mean, there are 11 players within two shots of the lead, and there are seven major champions there. It goes deep, to take a look at some of these stories. And as we talked about yesterday, Marty, everybody brings with them their own story. Francesco Molinari, I mean, the year that he had last year and continues to have this year, it's hard to think that anybody could be cooler than this guy. He just continues to win. He's never really been close here. Jason Day, that's a pretty compelling story. Here's a guy who's been very, very close here on a couple of occasions. Third or better twice, 27 putts today. But this is a guy who's struggling with back trouble. I mean, real back trouble.
Let me read this to you. On that note, I found this fascinating. His press conference after his round was one of the most interesting press conferences I've ever been in professionally. I just want to read you this real quick. Some of the preparation that he has to do to prepare to play. Quote, I have to get my rib cage back in position. So my rib cage is out of position. So you have your pelvic floor, your rib cage, and the bottom of your mouth. This is my trainer talking, not me, he says. This comes straight from him. When my back was sore last week, my rib cage was out, and I was aligned. My left shoulder was high. If you look at the back line where my pants are in the back, you could see my hips were kind of shifted and tilted. This is where it gets weird, okay? I blow into balloons in certain positions to try to get my rib cage down, but then I also try other exercises to get space in the joint with regards to my hips and my back and my shoulders, and it takes 30 minutes in the morning to get it done.
Well,
that is insane to me.
Well, I have to tell you, what makes me smile about that is I have the same issues.
No way.
I don't blow into the balloons, but I totally understand what he's talking about.
So give us some perspective then. For him to go out and perform like this with that type of back issue is what?
Well, it's kind of remarkable. I can say that I don't think I could shoot 67 from the pro tees here with my back issues. Of course, I couldn't shoot 67 from the pro tees here if I... I can't even think
borrow
of the comparison.
Jason's talent.
Whatever. I couldn't do it under any circumstance. But, I mean, everybody's got their issues. I mean, I go down the line. It's why this tournament year after year delivers the fascination that it does, because it's a short field. So what is it, 85 or 87 this year in the field? Something like that. You can probably eliminate, we talked about this yesterday, the first-timers, a number of the former major champions who are not necessarily going to be competitive, the amateurs. And you are left with a distilled group of the best players in the world. A normal PGA Tour event is 155, 156 people. you know, this is almost half of that. And so what do you have at the top of the leaderboard? You've got Dustin Johnson, you know, looking for his second major championship. You've got Louis Oosthuizen, you know, who has won an Open championship, shoots 66 today. You've got guys lurking. You've got Justin Thomas. He shoots 68 today. You've got, you know, you've got Tiger. You've got Xander Schauffele, who has yet to win a major championship, but I think most people are of the opinion that it's just inevitable with him. He shoots 65. So, I mean, there's so much going on here, and that's actually why Saturday is going to be a fascinating day. People call it moving day. It's a little bit of a cliche. I like to think of it as separation day because it's when the story truly makes itself.
One last thing, and we'll wrap it up. Obviously, mental fortitude is such an important part of this, becoming a Masters champion. Mm-hmm. And Day was saying that on Thursday night with his back issues, he was moping. He was just moping. Mm-hmm. And his wife basically looked at him and said, hey, man, you got to suck it up. This is the Masters. If you're going to have any chance, you better suck it up. And then I loved what Koepka said today. Koepka fascinates me with his approach to the game. I love this comment. Someone was asking if his attitude is beneficial. I don't know if it's my attitude, he said. I just think I know I can beat a lot of people mentally. Some people don't think I'm mentally tough or tough in general, but I think I am. I've proven that with three trophies. He means major championships. I feel like no matter how things are going, whether they're going really well or really poorly, I can grind it out, especially during a major. And he is proving that yet again.
I got to tell you something. I don't know what world he's looking at that there are people out there who don't think he's tough. I mean, who are these people who don't think he's tough?
I truly believe that he lives. You know who he reminds me of? Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
He reminds me so much of Aaron Rodgers, the Green Bay Packers quarterback, because they, no matter what level of success they attain, they will find a way to maintain this chip on their shoulder. It is a driving factor for them emotionally and psychologically, and I see so many similarities between the two.
Well, I will say this. Okay, so he's obviously got an enormous amount of talent, but I think he's got the right attitude. I listen to him, and I hear a guy who does not get undone by the big moment. He's motivated clearly by slights, but I think he's also, in listening to him, I heard him say yesterday, he said, look, a major championship, it's 72 holes. You cannot become undone by one hole on Friday. And look, he double bogeyed the second hole today. Second hole is a, you know, is a slam dunk scoring opportunity for somebody like him. It's one of the easiest holes on the course. He double bogeys it, but he does not become undone by moments like that. And in the end, you know, it's a cliche, but it's the truth. You know, you can't win a tournament on Friday, but you sure can lose it. And he did. He's the kind of player who truly understands that and seems to pace himself and lives in the moment.
What a tremendous day of golf.
Friday. Yet again, right?
It's just so wonderful to be here and see it in person. Jimmy, thank you so much for your perspective.
Marty, it's good to be with you again.
I always enjoy so much getting the perspective of folks like Jimmy Roberts. Jimmy's first Masters was 1991. He's covered so many of them throughout the years, so his catalog of memories and knowledge and perspective is so vast. It's wonderful to hear his thoughts. Really appreciate Jimmy's time. Now let's hear from ESPN's Mike Greenberg, an avid golf fan making his first trip to the Masters. Thrilled to now welcome Mike Greenberg, my ESPN colleague. Of course, Mike hosts Get Up each morning on ESPN. He hosted SportsCenter forever. He's had myriad roles at ESPN, and he's here at Augusta hosting our Masters coverage here throughout the week for SportsCenter and other various platforms. First of all, thanks so much for your time. You've been to a lot of amazing sporting events throughout your career. Where does the Masters rank on that list?
Number one, at the very top. I've said that all week leading up. This is the only time in my career that anyone asked me if I was interested in an assignment, and my response was, are you kidding? It was the first time I've ever said that. And I've told people this, that the experience of being here for the tournament is one of the very few things in life that people can build up for you to the point where the expectations are almost impossible to exceed, and yet still exceed them. And that's what this has been for me. I've been here for 2 days now, and it's just remarkable. It is remarkable to me how many people you can put in this area and yet have it all appear as orderly as it is, how happy everyone seems to be. I think everyone is just so happy to be here. It doesn't hurt that it is an absolutely stunning, picture-perfect, beautiful day outside, and the golf course looks spectacular. So I'm beyond excited to be here. I've tried in a few interviews I've done leading up to this to come up with a new word, because excited doesn't quite do it justice. I've been a broadcaster for 30 years, and I don't recall ever feeling the way I feel this week about being here.
It's funny, Rory McIlroy was discussing Augusta for those who may not have been, and he was talking about how his favorite time here is not during the Masters. It's when it's quiet and when it's docile. He said it's like walking into an empty church. And I've tried many times to my friends who've not attended the Masters to try to articulate to them what it is. And that's the first time I've ever heard anyone say it in a way where I went, okay, that encapsulates the spiritual element. It encapsulates the reverent element. There's so many elements about Augusta National that just don't apply to sport in any other way.
That's correct. And I've spent some time this week thinking about why. And I think there are two reasons. One of them is, it is without competition, I believe, the most telegenic golf course in the world. There is just no place else. And Pebble Beach is spectacular and beautiful. And so many of the courses that are in the British Open rotation are spectacular and beautiful. But there is just nothing that quite matches the colors and the pictures that you get on television watching Augusta National every year. And then the second piece of it is the history. There isn't a single place on this golf course that you can't name at least one thing right. You've seen happen there, one incredibly memorable thing that you've seen happen there. I've seen the U.S. Open played at Pebble Beach in my lifetime probably seven times. I've seen the British Open played at St. Andrews 6 or 7 times. Those are among the most famous golf courses in the world. I've seen the Masters played at Augusta National in my life 40 times. Mm-hmm. And there is just no substitute for that. And so it is a religious experience. The opportunity to actually get to be here and be a small part of it is a thrill beyond words. And I'm, as I am every year, I'm just enormously interested to see how it will unfold. I think there is endless intrigue and drama in this year's field, as there always is. It is the best sporting event of the year, and I think it is about as wide open this year as it has been in as long as I can remember.
There's a certain responsibility for us as partners, us at ESPN and certainly CBS and the other outlets who are affiliated with the tournament, to disseminate the passion of the tournament and to disseminate the spirit of the tournament. How would you describe that responsibility in your role?
Well, first and foremost, I have been, as you mentioned, as you introduced me so nicely, I've been a talk show host most of my career, which means that generally speaking, I do a show that people are tuning into, be it for all the years I was on the radio or now on television, to hear what I have to say about something. For me personally, the mindset is very different because there are a combined total of 2 people on planet Earth who are watching this week because I'm doing the Masters, and they are my wife and my mother.
That is fantastic.
Everyone else wants to see the Masters, as I would if I were at home watching, and I would not want to watch anyone like me, no matter how much I may like them, talk about how excited they are to be there. My job, for the time that I am privileged enough to sit in that chair, alongside Andy North and Curtis Strange and anyone else, is to present the Masters in as professional a way and as thorough a way as I possibly can to all of the people who love golf and love this event. And what I tried to do as I was thinking about how I wanted to do it is I tried to ask of my analysts as I was on today the questions that I always find myself wondering when I'm at home. So, for example, the way I think we can, particularly in the early stages of the tournament, the Thursday and Friday coverage, what I think we can try and present to people is what you are seeing, what does it portend as the weekend goes on? I tried to ask a lot of questions this morning when I was on with Andy and Curtis. What are the most important things Tiger Woods needs to do today? What will you be looking for on the opening hole, in the first few holes, to get a sense of what we should expect? And, of course, these things don't always hold up. We know that Tiger Woods, the first time he won the Masters, had a very poor front nine on the first day and then set the new scoring record along the way. So those things can obviously change on a dime. But for the most part, that's the mentality I've tried to bring to it. I think our job is to present the tournament professionally and thoroughly and accurately, and let people, I will let people make their own conclusions as to how emotionally invested they become in it. Because I think there are at minimum two sets of people who watch. One are people like us, like obviously you and I, who feel about this place as we have just described.
Right.
That there is something about this place that is just different than anywhere else on Earth. And it is something larger. This is something larger than just a sporting event. But I'm also very cognizant that there are lots of people, millions of people, who are watching because it is a sporting event, because they're interested in seeing Tiger Woods and the other best golfers in the world play one of the most beautiful and challenging golf courses in the world and see how it all turns out. So I tried, at least in my presentation, not to go too much into my own personal reverence for what was going on and try to cover it as best I can as what it is, which is one of the legitimately important sporting events of the year.
For whatever reason, I find that to be so difficult personally. I'm in a very different role than you are.
Yeah.
I'm discussing pieces that I've pre-produced with our tremendous producers about various golfers or moments or elements of the sport. But when I'm discussing Augusta National and I'm discussing the Masters, there's this visceral emotion that you have to include in those descriptions because it is a spiritual thing, and you use the word religious. I agree with that word. I think when you come here, you conduct yourself in a very different fashion than you might outside these walls. I always say that the respect for the grounds permeates the patrons. You respect your fellow man more here, and it's weird, but it's true. It's such an interesting dynamic. Now, a moment ago, you were discussing every single hole. You can note that moment. What is the Masters moment for you as a fan for so long?
Well, so I'm going to have to name a few, and then we'll try and narrow it down to one. So there are the magnificent moments, and there are the heartbreaking moments, and those carry equal weight. I think if I have to the very first thing that jumped to my mind when you asked me the question was what happened to Jordan Spieth on number 12 in 2016. And I hate to say that because you don't want to lead with this terrible heartbreaking moment that he had. You don't want to immediately think of Greg Norman in 1996. You don't want to immediately think of those moments where these great players had their dreams dashed. You want to think of the moments of inspiration, like what Tiger Woods did on 16 that year. And I just saw it again the other day. And I tell you, the broadcast is such a part of that. Vern Lundquist,
his
capturing
call?
The moment by saying, in your life,
yeah,
have you ever seen anything like that? It was so perfect. But I will be honest. And so there are so many of those moments as well, of course. Adam Scott yelling, come on, Aussie, when he made that putt in the rain to win it in extra holes against Cabrera. There are those that are jumping to my mind, but sometimes your first answer, the first thing that pops into your head is the best answer. I would say Spieth on 12 in 16, and for a variety of reasons. One is the extraordinary heartbreak of it. The second is the sporting consequence of it, the significance to the sport. Think about where we were. 2015. Jordan Spieth wins the Masters and shoots the best score in the history of the event and ties Tiger Woods' record for the largest margin of victory in the history of the event. Then he wins the U.S. Open. Then he was right there with a chance to win the British Open and right there with a chance to win the PGA Championship. Circle the calendar, come back the next year, and he is running away in hiding with the Masters. Mm-hmm. So we are living in a moment until he steps to the 12th tee, where Jordan Spieth is by far the best player in the world, is separating himself from everyone in a way that we hadn't seen anyone since Tiger at his peak. And that was going to be the new normal. And then 12 happened. Then he hits the ball in the water and he has a variety of options and chooses one that for the rest of my life I'll never understand to drop the ball where he went and dropped it. And the entire world changes. Now he doesn't win that Masters. Now he isn't running away with being the best player in the world. He has won one major championship, of course, since then, a remarkable comeback at the British Open at Birkdale. But the whole sport changed. I mean, everything about golf changed on that one hole. And so that is the first thing that jumps to my mind. And again, there's a part of me that hates myself for thinking of a moment of despair rather than a moment of glory. But that is the first thing that jumped to my mind.
In what other sport and in what other event in sport Is one man alone, sure they have their caddy, is one man alone on that type of stage with that type of pressure? And it's funny, I was speaking with Kyle Larson, the NASCAR driver, on the podcast about what it's like when you're in the arena and what it's like when everyone is watching you. Golf's unlike anything else, and especially here. What do you make of that level of pressure here for them?
Here's what I love the most about the sport, and I spend all of my free time reading golf books. And my favorite—I read more golf psychology books than anyone else does anything. And Bob Rotella is my favorite. And what I think makes golf so compelling to me is that that pressure that you are describing comes from two different things. One is your own battle with yourself, and the other is time. It is the only one where there is no limit, practically speaking, on how long it can take you to make the decisions you are making. And as you and I and any person knows, sometimes an abundance of time is the worst enemy you can have when making a decision. Yep. Right? So you and I both, we cover football a lot. If the NFL held their draft a month after the college football season ended, in my opinion, teams would make much better decisions. But by waiting 4 months, they talk themselves into one mistake after another. And that's what we see happen in golf. It is that battle with yourself. Golf is the only sport where you compete only against the course, which means you're competing against yourself rather than competing with any other opponent, even in the other individual sports. In tennis, I'm playing against you. In boxing, I'm fighting you. In golf, I'm playing my game and you're playing yours. And whoever winds up being best wins. And that makes this the greatest sport, in my opinion, my favorite sport by far, and the most unique of all. And for some reason, when you were asking me the question, this story jumped into my mind, and I want to tell it even if it isn't a specific answer to what you asked me. Years and years and years ago on Mike and Mike, I asked Tiger Woods the following question. And this was at a time when he was dominating the sport in a way that maybe no one ever had. During that period of time where Tiger Woods was probably the best golfer that had ever lived. And I asked him, have you ever walked off the golf course and thought to yourself, that was the best I'm capable of playing? That was the absolute best. I'm not capable of being better than that. And his answer was, no, and I never will. And I think that is what makes golf so unique, is that for those of us who by our nature are aspirational, who expect a lot of ourselves and never stop trying, who are not competitive isn't the right word, who are determined, it brings that out in us because you can't perfect it. You can't beat it. In baseball, there's a perfect game. Mm-hmm. You can't beat this game. You can't be perfect at it. And that is what makes it so compelling to me, to watch these, the best players in the world, try as hard as they can to do something that is impossible, which is to be perfect, and to try and win a prize that, candidly, if you told me I could have anything in the world, I would choose a green jacket. I remember this was a great debate we used to have on the old show. If there was any prize you could ever have, an Olympic gold medal or whatever it might be, what would you choose? And mine was always a green jacket. So that was a very rambling answer to a reasonably concise question. Golf is the best game because it forces people to compete, to try to conquer themselves, their own worst tendencies, and that is the hardest thing to do.
As you say that, the only thing I can think of is marathoning, because you're not running against someone else. You're running against a clock in the course in front of you. It's obviously still different fundamentally than golf, but it's the only thing that is even remotely applicable.
I think that is a good choice, a good example, because I've never run a marathon. But it would seem to me that at some point in it, you are in a battle. Have you run a marathon?
Yes,
okay.
Multiple.
I have to believe that in your own... You're in a fight with yourself, right?
You're
in a battle against your natural inclination to quit.
And your insecurities.
Yeah.
And your fears and every little feeling that you have. And, oh, my swing right now feels just a tick off. Now it's in my head. My gait feels a little bit off. Now it's in my head. What's that going to mean 7 miles from now? It's applicable in certain ways. How's your game? How often do you get to play?
Well, I have a job that ends at 10 o'clock in the morning, Marty. I started hosting Mike and Mike of the Morning in January of 2000. And at that time, my handicap was 24. And I'm pleased to say that after 19 years of a schedule that ends at 10 o'clock in the morning, I've written 5 books and I've taken 16 shots off my handicap.
Wow.
So I play to an 8 now. And I would like to make a shout out on this podcast, which I would assume everyone who is listening loves the game of golf, that the difference in my life that a PGA professional made is it is almost impossible for me to put into words. If I had to list the 10 most important people in my life, my golf pro would be one of them. And I'll tell you why. I was going to quit. I took up the game in my 20s. I did not play as a kid. I took up the game in my 20s, and I did the worst thing you can do, which is I bought a set of inexpensive clubs, and I went out, and I tried to teach myself a swing. And so I ingrained into my game all of the worst habits you could ever conceivably have. And so not only was I bad, but I was getting worse rather than better the more that I played.
I just did a whole piece on this.
It was so excruciating, and I remember thinking to myself, why am I doing this? This is my leisure time. It isn't my job. Why am I spending all of this money and all of this time and all of this energy into something that causes me so much angst? And there was something in the back of my mind that knew I wanted to keep trying, but I was genuinely going to quit. I was standing on the driving range at the club at which I am a member in Wilton, Connecticut. It's called Rolling Hills Country Club. I'm standing on the driving range, and I'm hitting one terrible slice after another, and I was as frustrated as I've ever been. And a PGA professional, our director of instruction, his name is Dan Tisvanis, walked by me, and he looked at me. He said, "Greeny, you don't look happy." I said, "Dan, I'm not happy." And he said, "I can see what's going on here." And he said, "And we can fix it. But if you weighed 350 pounds and you said to me, Dan, I want to weigh 150 pounds, I couldn't say to you, okay, give up bread. I would say this is going to require a complete lifestyle change. So that's what this is going to be. So if you want to get better at golf, we can do this, but it's going to require a complete change in your game." And so I said, "I do want to do this." So we started with my grip, and then we went to my path, and then we went to any number of things. And my index at that time was 21 point something, and it has been as low as 7.4. And I can tell you I have traveled all over the world. I have a group of guys that we travel all over the world. I have been all over England, all over Scotland, all over Ireland, all over Australia playing this game. I've gotten more joy out of playing the game of golf than practically anything that does not involve my family in my entire life. And all of that is thanks to the fact that I allowed a PGA professional to help teach me how to play this game. And so I know that isn't the purpose of this podcast, but I really, for anyone who loves golf, I would advise that. It changed my life. It changed my game. And it has opened up an entire world to me that I think would otherwise not have been available.
Phenomenally said. A couple more things, and I'll let you run. You noted Spieth tying Tiger's scoring record. Tiger has 4 green jackets, right? How would you begin to define his impact on the game of golf?
It's almost impossible to do. I think that more people began playing golf as a consequence of Tiger Woods playing golf than any person since Arnold Palmer in his heyday. And I'm not old enough to remember that, of course. Arnold Palmer's heyday came a decade before I was born. But my sense of it is that he brought more people to this wonderful party that we call this game of golf than anyone has since Arnold Palmer, and maybe even more. So there's that piece. Then there's the Renaissance. You know, there was Tiger at his best when he was almost like a machine. You know, a shark is, I remember writing this once, a shark is more like a machine than like a beast, because of the simplicity of its purpose. It seems to have no emotion whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It just swims and it eats, and it doesn't have any other function and any other thought. And that's sort of what Tiger was, right? That's how he seemed during his pinnacle. He just walked with that stare on his face, and he played golf like we'd never seen anyone play golf before. And then all the things that have happened in his life happened. And in his Renaissance now, it is so different. But I can tell you that last year when he played in the Valspar Open, mm-hmm. it felt like you were watching the Ryder Cup. It felt like it was that important. And when he did what he did at the PGA Championship, that day that he was playing in the PGA Championship, which I think is generally considered to be the fourth of the majors, mm-hmm. it felt like the most important golf you'd ever watched in your entire life. And I made this comparison on my show. Tiger Woods playing golf has now superseded sports. It is sort of like, the comparison I made was Beyonce at Coachella, where all of a sudden this performance is going on at this venue that everyone knows and is aware of, that we weren't really expecting, and everyone you know is texting everyone you know saying, are you watching this? Mm-hmm. Are you seeing what's happening right now? David Letterman used to say, phone the neighbors, wake the dog. you have to see what's happening here. What Tiger Woods is doing, you cannot miss this. It is bigger than sport somehow. He is that. And if he should do that again, and I would not put it past him. He is not my pick to win here this week, but a year ago, if he had won this tournament, you would have been floored. You would have bet anything that anyone would have offered you that it couldn't happen. That wouldn't be the case now, of course. But if he does actually win this tournament, to see him win any major again would be substantial, would be significant. To see him win the Masters again, to see Tiger Woods win the Masters, the greatest player, win the greatest event, I think would be the biggest thing that could happen in sports right now. There is nothing that could happen in the world of sports that would be more consequential, in my opinion, than Tiger Woods winning the Masters.
Fantastic stuff, brother. Thank you for your time.
So good to see you, Marty. Thank you for having me.
When someone like Mike Greenberg, who has been a lead voice in all of sport for so many years, more than two decades, says that the Masters is the pinnacle of the sporting experience for the fan or the patron, you know it's extremely special. It's so fun for me to see people of that pedigree with that type of resume and that type of experience be utterly giddy about the Masters experience. Really appreciate Mike's time. And Greeny isn't the only person who shares that sentiment. Certainly, we've heard so many people throughout the week on the Four Please Now Driving official Masters podcast discuss their adoration for the moment of seeing the Masters for the first time. So why not add one more? Now it's time for my conversation with NASCAR star Kyle Larson, winner of five races at NASCAR's highest level. Not only does he compete against other drivers on the racetrack on Sunday, he also competes against several of them on the golf course throughout the week. Here's my conversation with NASCAR driver Kyle Larson. Thrilled now to have my man, NASCAR star Kyle Larson, joining the Four Please Now Driving official Masters podcast. It's so good to see you, first of all. It's been a while since I've been in the garage. This is your first Masters experience. How would you even begin to detail it?
Overwhelming. I knew there'd be a lot of people. I didn't know that there'd be that many people all over the place. So it's crazy.
It's impossible to describe what Augusta National really looks like to someone who's never been here. You basically cannot properly describe it.
No.
How would you describe it?
Well, yeah, just how hilly it is unreal. TV, you don't get the sense of, you know, how up and down this course is. 18 fairway up to the 18 green. It is insane. I felt like the fairways look pretty wide, but the greens look really small. And just how green it is here is awesome. Just the landscaping is great.
One thing that I love about this place is the beauty in simplicity. No phones.
Yeah.
You don't have cameras. You are truly immersed in the moment with your friends and your family. Very few places that's the case anymore. What's that like?
This is the only place I feel like I've ever been where you can't have a cell phone or camera or anything, any technology. So, part of it is really neat, because you actually have to talk to people and you're not focused on your phone. But then I wish that I could take pictures and, you know, show people, you know, the experiences that we've had here, you know, just driving over to this media center and it'd be cool to, like, snap a photo of this building. But, it is, you know, I think the memories that you get to have just in your head is cool.
How would you compare this experience to, like, the Daytona 500, which is the Super Bowl of NASCAR?
I
know you're competing in that, so yeah, there are certain differences.
I think it'd be hard for me to compare. I think, you know, you could probably do a better job just because you're on the other side of it. You know, when I'm racing, you know, I don't get to experience the fan zone or what's going on behind the grandstands. I get a little bit of, you know, what's going on in the infield and all the celebrities and stuff. But, you know, here being a fan, you know, it's really cool just to go. I could go watch those guys practice on the range or around, you know, you know, hitting sand shots and chipping and stuff like that. So just being able to get close to the players and how fans can get close to us, you know, at any race is similar. I don't think there's really many other sports where you can get as close to the athlete as you can in golf and racing. But gosh, just the amount of people at the 500 on Sunday, and then, you know, I think you have more than that here all week, but, it's unreal.
One way that they are certainly linked is the emphasis on the event, the notice of the event, even for people that aren't hardcore fans, mm-hmm. people that don't consume it on a weekly, certainly daily basis, are paying attention to the Daytona 500 and they're paying attention to the Masters. Now, all golfers want to try to consider this just another golf tournament in their mind. You want to try to consider the Daytona 500 just another race in your mind. That's laughable to me. It's a lie.
Yeah, I think.
What's the difference for the competitor when it's this level of emphasis?
I think leading up to the event, or at least for me, and with, you know, big races that I want to win, I think I do a good job of just treating it as another event. But then when you actually strap in and you're getting to compete, that's when you can't you understand how big the race is or whatever. So I'm sure for these guys, you know, maybe leading up, you know, they don't do anything different. They don't let the nerves get to them, but then probably when they, you know, get to that first tee box, I'm sure it feels different here than it might next week. So, that obviously, you know, means it's not your typical event, you know, it means something more. So, I don't know what those guys are thinking, but that's what I would be thinking.
So speaking of the Daytona 500, the current Daytona 500 champion, our buddy Denny Hamlin, all right, you guys have this golf guys thing. For those of you listening who don't follow NASCAR or its driving core, several of these guys, Kyle included, have a basically weekly tournaments, right?
Once a month.
Okay, monthly tournaments.
But we do golf every week, a couple times a week.
And several drivers participate. I want you to take me through the passion within the driving core for the game. And not just the driving core, the entire garage. Yeah. I know several of your friends that work in the industry also participate.
Yeah.
What is the passion for golf in the NASCAR industry?
So I just got into golf about 4 years ago. I never golfed before. You know, just here and there with my friends. Didn't really enjoy it, but now I love it. And a lot of it's come from this Golf Guys tour that we have. And there's 21 of us. You know, it's all off your handicap. You have Stableford system. So, you know, I'm a 16 handicap. You know, Denny's a 6. So he's got to score more points than I do. Bogeys are a point. Pars 2. Birdie 4. Eagle 7, I think. But yeah, so we just had our first event at the Old Farm in Virginia.
Love that course.
Awesome. Love it. They treat us amazing every time we go there. But yeah, I finished third. We have a PGA professional, I guess, sales rep. But he shot, in the 2 days we played, he shot like a 65 the first day.
What?
And a 68 or 9 the second day to win. So I can't compete with that. Nope. Almost did. I lost to him by 2 points. I had my best 9 at the Old Farm. I shot a 38 on the back 9.
That's fantastic.
But I shot a 46 on the front. But
that's,
yeah,
golf.
It's just fun. You know, it's fun to get together with everybody and go to amazing courses. That's, I tell everybody, my favorite part about being a NASCAR driver is getting to golf at really nice places. So I just enjoy doing it, and you know, I want to be way better than I am. I've gotten a lot better in the last year. But yeah, I want to get to where I can actually beat Denny without getting strokes.
Who's the best golfer among the drivers? Denny?
Denny probably. Stenhouse is, if you match Stenhouse and Denny together where they're,
that's
playing
Ricky
against
Stenhouse
each other.
That's Ricky Stenhouse Jr., for those of you guys who may know. He's number 17.
Yeah. If they play together, Ricky can get in Denny's head and beat Denny usually most of the time. But
how does Ricky go about getting in Denny's head?
He's just, I don't know. He just does. I think, you know, Denny tries so hard and you know, wants to beat Ricky really bad. But yeah, Ricky just seems to get the better of him most times they play.
How often when you're at a specific location for a race do you guys get together and play golf at some point during that weekend?
Most Saturdays, cause practice will be done, you know, at 12:30, between 12:30 and 1, then Denny will have his team meeting. So we'll usually leave the track, you know, 2 o'clock and then, get a quick 18 in at whatever course, you know, is, you know, within 20 minutes away. So Yeah, we play most Saturdays, and then during the week we'll play on like a Tuesday or Wednesday, maybe Thursday.
One thing people may not realize about NASCAR drivers is the mental aspect of it. It can be a mentally exhausting exercise for you guys with the adjustments that you're thinking about throughout the race to make your car faster, and then over 400 or 500 miles at the end of that, your mind's pretty cooked. Golf, too, is similar. I know you're not playing at a professional level, but as often as you guys
play... The GGT is pretty professional.
What do you think the similarities are in terms of the mental aspect of the sport?
I think, you know, something that's pretty easy to compare to would be, you know, when you're getting down to the, you know, final three holes or something, and you're in the running to win, you know, and those pressure 4-foot putts are pretty equal to, I feel like, what would be a final restart, you know, when you're on the front row with Kyle Busch or Jimmy Johnson or something like that, you know. So it's just hard to keep your nerves down and just focus on hitting your marks or reading your line right or getting the speed right, whatever. So I would say that, and then, you know, the first tee is always intense and sketchy. I usually don't hit many first fairways.
Tiger Woods still gets nervous
yes.
on the first tee every single tournament, which I don't understand that. He's Tiger Woods, but he told me that himself. So
yeah.
It's fascinating. Who would you say is NASCAR's Jack Nicklaus?
I think Jimmy Johnson's the greatest NASCAR driver ever.
Why?
I don't know, I guess because he's my generation. and I feel like our sport's only gotten tougher and tougher. You know, the equipment's gotten more equal. The drivers, you know, have more resources to be better. So I think Jimmy's the greatest. But then obviously, you know, Dale Sr. and Richard Petty, you know, they all have 7 championships. So they're all up there as well. But for me, getting to compete with Jimmy and see the things that he's been able to do, maybe not recently, but it is pretty amazing to watch and you know, how much stuff he's got going on in his life, and for him to still be able to show up on Sundays and be the best is crazy.
I think Jimmy's sort of like Tiger.
Yeah.
Because of the generational thing, with all that success in such an era with so much parity. So maybe Richard Petty is the golden bear, just not only because of the success, but also because of the passion for growing the game and sustaining the game that Richard has had all of this time as this fan favorite. I've never even thought of that comparison before, but since you're sitting here with me,
I'm glad
we got to have it. What's your favorite Masters memory or moment as a fan?
So honestly, like I said, I didn't really follow golf much until a few years ago, and I would say really the first Masters I watched like all week was when, you know, Jordan Spieth won, and you know, him just being, I think he's younger than I am.
He's young.
And I mean, just understanding how much pressure he had to go through all week and to score what he did, and you know, each day being as good as he was really cool. And I just remember him, you know, them, you know, letting him walk up, you know, up to the green on the final hole, you know, by himself, was just something. It was a really cool moment to watch on TV. But yeah, so I mean, I follow golf now every week. I watch more golf than I do practice and stuff when it's on TV. It's my TV in the motorhome is stuck on 218 quite a bit.
They will be thrilled to know that. Have you gotten to know any of the golfers? Which guys are friends of yours?
Yeah, I haven't met really any. I got to play in the Pro-Am at Quail Hollow last year, which was a lot of fun. And I was paired up with Russell Henley. Awesome. So he was a super nice guy. He had just had his first child, I think, right before that. I think they're pregnant again. But Caitlin, we had our second child a week after that. So, like, you know, we got to talk about children quite a bit, which was cool. And he gave me some pointers and things like that. But, yeah, we're playing in that pro-am again this year. It'll be me, Ricky Stenhouse Jr., and Denny all in a group. So hopefully we can get paired up with somebody really good.
That'll be fun. So you're at the Quail Hollow Pro-Am 2018, and you're walking to the first tee. What are your nerves?
Oh, my gosh. So, hey, I got a funny story about Quail before we get to the first tee box. So I didn't realize that we're on the driving range with, like, the pros. And, you know, it's just a couple weeks after Masters. Patrick Reed just won. I'm like, you know, he's just a couple spots down from me. And I'm like so nervous, And I'm like a 20 handicap at the time. And so I'm like, all right, I go do like my first practice, just like half practice swing. And my club nicks the ball and it goes straight down the driving range. If I had my phone, I could show you. I have a video of it. And it rolls right across the front of his feet. I'm like, oh my God. But so yeah, I was so nervous after that. So then getting the first tee, yeah, I didn't check my heart rate or anything, but it had to be like
180.
Yeah, it was max. And but I hit the first fairway, and that relieved a lot of stress. It probably took 4 holes though until I really like got somewhat calmed down.
So I'm a little ignorant about one last thing, and we'll let you go back to the tournament and enjoy yourself. It's so fun for me to have gotten to know several of these golfers and interviewing them like this and spending time with them. And there's really not much more that gives them confidence and fills up their tank like Jack Nicklaus or Tiger Woods or one of these legends acknowledging their own talent. Very few guys got that type of acknowledgement from guys like Tony Stewart, Jeff Gordon, absolute championship legends of NASCAR like you did. Mm-hmm. Before a lot of us even knew your name, they were telling us your name. How did that impact you?
Yeah, that was really awesome. Yeah, so in 2011, I won. So there's 3 races in one night at Eldora Speedway, midgets, sprint cars, and Silver Crown cars. My first time there racing, and I won all 3. I was the second driver ever to do that. And I just remember after that, you know, watching, you know, NASCAR, you know, race day or whatever it was called the next day on TV, and yeah, they're like interviewing Jeff Gordon about me and Tony Stewart, Casey Kane, and like, you know, I'm hearing people talk about me on national television, and then, you know, Wind Tunnel later that night with Dave Despain. So I was like, wow, this is crazy. And then it just kept going on, you know, for a few weeks of, I felt like, you know, every week Jeff Gordon was talking about me and Tony Stewart and guys like that. And I mean, it still continues too. So it makes you, I mean, I'm sure the same way. It probably makes you feel special when you hear guys and gals, you know, say good things about you. So, especially when it's people that you've looked up to in racing for a long time. So, I'm very thankful for it. You know, I don't think if guys like that didn't talk about me, it wouldn't have gotten my name out there as quickly and as big as it did. And I don't think Chip Ganassi would have wanted to hire me as quickly as he did. So it all worked out. And then for me to be able to compete against those guys before they all retired, was really neat. I had some, you know, great battles with all of them. So really, really cool. And, always be fans of theirs and extremely thankful for everything they've done for me.
Such amazing stuff, man. Thank you for your time. Enjoy this.
Yes.
It's the Masters, man.
I know. It's awesome. Thanks for having me.
Good luck with that handicap.
Thank you.
I've wanted to ask Kyle Larson for some time now what it was like for him as a young driver, up and coming, whom many had not heard of, to hear iconic legends like Jeff Gordon and Tony Stewart champion his name and his talent and his future. It has such an indelible impact on him as a competitor, and it's so fun to compare it to the way Brooks Koepka has talked to me in the past about Tiger Woods, or Rory McIlroy has discussed with me his appreciation and thankfulness for Arnold Palmer. Thank you so much for listening to Four Please Now Driving, the official Masters podcast. We're doing this every night through the tournament's completion until someone puts a green jacket on his back and celebrates history. Good night from Augusta National Golf Club.